Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. I'm Russell Biggin, and I'm joined once again by my co-host, Cricket Group's Andrew Nixon. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, welcome. How are you?
Lots to talk about today. We'll begin with a wrap-up of the East Asia Pacific Division 1 T20, which was won by Papua New Guinea, who went undefeated, defending 159 for 6 against Vanuatu, who's 121 in the final. And I'm pleased to have with us someone who was there for the entire tournament, I believe, Avi Singh. Avi is a freelance journalist based in Auckland who is a regular scorer and commentator at the world's leading cricket website, ESPN Cricket Info. In addition to being a poor man's Mark Richardson, who plays for the Ellerslie Cricket Club in Auckland, where he also serves in the community of Vice President, Secretary and Communications Manager, is on Twitter at Manner of Speaking. Welcome, Avi.
Thanks very much for having me on, Ross and Andrew.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge. As I said, you attended the tournament throughout. What were your general impressions on the tournament and the standard of play?
I went in with an open mind. I haven't seen most of these teams playing before, and I have to say I was very impressed throughout the whole week. I thought the standard of cricket was very good, considering the backgrounds of some of these countries and the limited resources and facilities they have. I was very impressed with the overall standard of the tournament, and I think particularly Papua New Guinea have a real chance of pushing to be in the top six at that World 2020 qualifier later this year and moving to the 2014 World 2020 in Bangladesh.
Yeah, especially as when they actually get to the global qualifier, they'll be strengthened by the experience of Gareth Jones, who played at the last qualifier and sort of helped bring on some of their younger players with his experience playing for England.
Yeah, that's right. He's actually not able to play in any of these regional tournaments. He is only allowed to play at the world qualifying tournaments, which is why he was not there at Auckland during the week. But yes, you're right. Definitely he would be another key factor in strengthening a pretty strong side already.
Yeah.
I read one article, I think from an Auckland journalist, that implied that some of the fielding was a bit dubious, except for PNG. From some of the other nations? Is that a fair comment?
I would say overall that yes, the fielding is probably the area that would most need improvement, and also it is the area where the most improvement can be made for these sides. Certainly PNG were an outstanding fielding side. I thought Vanuatu were usually very good. They had one off game against Indonesia. They dropped about 5 or 6 catches. But PNG and Vanuatu were certainly, on the whole, very good fielding sides. The other sides, they have their moments, but a lot more inconsistent. And particularly the Indonesians did really struggle in the field to cut down the singles and taking catches on the boundaries. And I think that is an area where improvement can be made, and it needs to be made, because that's how the better teams, if they're getting a run of ball at least, if every single with singles in 2020 and then you're getting yourself a boundary or two, then the score just piles up very quickly, and the Indonesians were just not able to prevent the rotation of the strike. So on balance, yes, the fielding needs improvement, but it wasn't all bad.
Did any particular players impress you or perhaps indicate that they might be able to move up to a level to play, you know, New Zealand first class cricket or something of that nature?
Yeah, definitely. From Papua New Guinea, there were a couple. Asad Vala, who's a left-hander who I believe had trialled with the Brisbane Heat Big Bash League team for the Australian Domestic 2020 competition, and he was outstanding throughout the tournament. He hit 157 not out against Indonesia off only 64 balls, and he had a couple of other blistering knocks. And he was a great striker of the ball. Also Chris Kent from Papua New Guinea. Looked a very nice player. Same with Charles Umeni, left-hander from Papua New Guinea. And again, these guys certainly didn't look out of place when facing some players who'd played Premier Club cricket in Auckland. And there were a couple in the Samoan team as well who were certainly showed they were capable of moving up. Also the Vanuatu captain, Andrew Mansale, who hit 2 unbeaten 90s on the opening day of the tournament. And he also looked like someone who, with the right coaching, with the right assistance, could certainly go further in the game if he had the assistance he needed.
If that is that type of assistance, is it where are they particularly lacking? Is it a technical thing, or like they have flaws that they need to, that they have enormous natural ability, but they have some technical flaws, or are they technically very sound and they just need more practice?
They certainly have the natural ability. I would say there are technical issues, and also just a game sense. And I think in terms of sort of being aware of how the game flows, the little things as well on the games, just the small little things, backing up when you're fielding, backing up when you're running between the wickets, and just sort of being aware of, you know, which bowlers to bowl in certain situations, where to put your fielders. And I think these things will develop over time, but there is a need for assistance in that regard from full member countries, especially with coaching, and obviously better facilities, especially with regard to grounds, would help. I noticed that a lot of the teams do have partnerships via the state-province partnership with the associations in Australia and New Zealand, so that's a good start, but I would say that probably there still needs to be some more assistance in that regard.
And that general sort of awareness of the game situation is something that I've sort of realised during my time covering European associates and affiliate cricket. Knowing when to bowl your bowlers, when to play your shots, especially in the 2020 game. Players in the European Division 1 that I was at in 2011 tended to try slogging maybe too early in the run chase, rather than wait towards the end to try and hit the big sixes and so on and so forth. And was that something that happened at the East Asia Pacific tournament as well?
Yes, to an extent, I'd agree with that as well. On the first couple of days, the tournament was held at Waikaraka Park in Auckland, which has got a lot of grass wickets, and they're usually uncovered, so they're fairly green, and they flattened out during the week, and later on, a lot of runs were scored. On the first couple of days, it did seem around quite a bit, and a few teams who'd only played on artificial wickets, such as Japan, just really seemed to struggle with how to approach setting a 2020 total for a team to chase. I think it seems as though they had a preconceived notion of we need to get 160, and that's a 2020 score, and they weren't able to adjust that down to reflect the nature of the wicket when, say, 120 would have been a good score. And that resulted in Japan being bowled out for 38 by Fiji in one of the games because the batsmen just didn't really try to defend. They just kept going for their shots, kept going for horizontal bat cut shots when the ball's nipping back in quite a bit. And that is probably an area, again, where that's the game sense thing coming in, and that's also partly related to the facilities on offer, because batting on seeming grass wickets was a very new experience for most of these players.
I know the PNG coach, the former PNG coach, Andy Bickle, made a comment once that one of the things he had to get around with PNG was that they would come into a game thinking, you get man of the match if you scored 30 and took two wickets, and he needed to make them say, look, you need to move beyond that and get beyond 30 and get 100 and take five wickets, because that's what you need to commit at will. But that was a couple of years ago. Are we starting to see that PNG are able to do that? They scored a few decent totals then in the tournament.
Yes, I think PNG certainly had the most advanced game sense of any team at the tournament. And yes, there were big scores from them, and batsmen did seem to realise that once they got in, it wasn't good enough to just get out after getting a quick 40. The aim was to go on and try and bat the full 20 overs and then let the other batsmen come in and bat around them. And I think in terms of the bowling, it's a little different. It's hard to take more than 2-3 wickets, I think, in 2020. And in terms of economy rate, well, the expectations have to be slightly downgraded because there were short boundaries and nicks and things flew fast. But in terms of the batting, certainly, I saw PNG had dipped by far and away the most advanced game sense, and that was also clear in the shot selection. Even when they lost early wickets, the middle order, because of their depth, the middle order was able to make sure that they played to the situation and then attacked later on, which we didn't see with the other teams, who were quite reliant on a few key players.
So one of the things with the PNG as well is that they were probably expected to do a little bit better, I think. I'm not sure in the sense that they did win every game, but it wasn't by quite as much as I think, in the past tournaments. They've were. Where do you see the gap between them and the next three sides, which is Samoa, Fiji, and Vanuatu?
Yeah, well, PNG did not dominate as much as people had expected, but I got the sense that they did enough to win at the tournament. I got the sense that definitely they weren't as ruthless as they could have been, and certainly they were very disappointed after their game against Samoa, which they won by 17 runs, and they treated that like a loss, which in a way is a good sign, that they weren't happy with just winning by a small margin, they did certainly still prove far too good, but yes, I mean, they probably didn't play to their full potential throughout the week. In terms of the gap, there is a gap, but Vanuatu showed that they were able to compete on an even par with PNG at times, but sustaining that over the whole 40 overs was probably the main issue, and that was probably the issue for the Samoans as well, and even the Fijians. The Fijians actually bowled Papua New Guinea out, and that was the first time anyone could remember PNG being bowled out at a regional tournament for quite a long time. So there's some good signs there, but certainly I think the batting is probably the big difference. PNG's batsmen are just far more skilled, and also the depth in their lineup. Again, they're not reliant on just two, three batsmen. They've got six, seven top-quality batsmen, whereas the other teams, Vanuatu, Samoa, Fiji, were reliant on three key performers firing.
Below those top four, the gap seemed much bigger. At least the table, I think, was like a 3-run-per-over difference in the net run rate. In the past, the East Asia Pacific's had a second-tier tournament, and that was removed, I think, for cost reasons. Andrew might be able to fill in.
Yeah, I think it's cost reasons across the board. The Americas dropped the tournaments as well. Their Division 3 tournament didn't take place in this cycle. It's really quite a shame, because in the last East Asia Pacific one, I think it was the Philippines did actually quite well, and actually, I think, finished in this Division 2 higher than Indonesia did, and would probably have played a bit better in this Division 1 tournament than Indonesia would have done. So it's, again, it's cost reasons. It's the time we live in. It's, you're flying people vast distances in this region, so it's difficult to rationalise having teams flying all over the place for these tournaments. It's a shame, but I think it's the time we live in. There probably is enough money in the ICC to do it, but it's allocated to, you know, higher up the food chain, unfortunately.
Yes, that's exactly right. The gap, yes, it was noticeable. Again, there were moments where Japan and the Cook Islands were able to compete, but again, yes, not for long enough periods. Indonesia was certainly outclassed. They were by far and away the laggards of the tournament. It's a difficult question. You think, well, on the one hand, these teams that are playing here do get exposure against a better quality of cricket, and they do see what is required to move up. And then on the other hand, you think, well, they're being smashed most games. How much good is this doing for their confidence? But I do think the Japanese and the Cook Islands would have learned something from this week, and I think on balance for those two teams, it was certainly a decent experience to come and play here, even if they did lose a few games. They also won a few, and I think the experience was good for them to come to a different country to play on grass wickets. They may not have got that opportunity if it was a second-tier tournament. But yes, I suppose for Indonesia, maybe they do need to look at things. They had a lot of issues administratively in the lead-up to this tournament. One player's visa was not sorted, so he had to miss the first flight, and he was delayed on arrival. The players turned up in Auckland and were not given their food allowance money, so one of the umpires had to buy them some dinner. And just generally, I think Indonesia is lagging in both playing and administrative standards. But yes, the money is the big thing, really, and this goes back to how the ICC is structured, where you've got the ICC being run by its own members, and particularly by its 10 big full members, who are really focused on what's best for them. And so, unfortunately, the development of the global game comes second. And that basically is why the Wolf Report recommendations really needed to be followed up, but I noticed that they have been basically whitewashed, but that is the way it goes, unfortunately, at the ICC level, and that's an unfortunate thing for the ICC. They do get blamed for a lot of things, but the reality is a lot of it is out of their control because of the way they are structured. The ICC can make all sorts of pushes to do all sorts of things, but ultimately if the full members on the ICC board do not agree to it, it won't happen, and unfortunately at the moment anything that takes away from the full members allocation is just not going to be agreed to, and that's why the ICC needs to be restructured.
Yeah, I've noticed as well that in ICC press releases on their meeting now, they don't even pretend to be discussing the Wolf Report anymore. It used to be one line at the bottom, you know, items relating to the Wolf Report were discussed. That doesn't even appear anymore. They're not even pretending to be discussing it. So I think it's been swept under the carpet, which is a real shame. See, it perhaps didn't go quite far enough, and it didn't address the financial situation in cricket, but it was a step, certainly a step in the right direction for cricket, and it's a shame it's been dropped.
Yes, well, it's no surprise that it's been dropped once the CEO championed it, Haroon Lorgat, departed the ICC. It was his brainchild. I'm fairly aware that most of the other members were not particularly keen on such a report, so it's no surprise that once he's ended his tenure, no further progress has been made in that regard, and I don't expect any further progress to be made in that regard in the near future either.
I think the four members didn't even actually want it to be published. It was Haroon Lorgat who actually insisted that it was published, so we may never have even known about it. We'd have known it would have happened and never got the report. So, and the fact that they didn't want it to be published actually says quite a lot about what is in it, even without you reading it.
Yes, that's correct. And that's the same goes for the Disbevel report, which was published in relation to the anti-corruption procedures. Again, full members not particularly keen on publishing that, but again, it was insisted by Mr. Lorgat that be done. And that just shows, in many ways, why the Wolf Report recommendations need to be put through, because there's a massive lack of transparency with these full members, and they just run the game as if they owe no duty of care to any other stakeholders, and that is a major problem, and maybe it is time that governments ironically do step in to at least ensure that there is appropriate disclosure of relevant information to the general public.
You know, it's quite noticeable that the one recommendation of the Wolf Report that was introduced almost straight away, which was the banning of government interference in cricket boards, was dropped within about, I think, 3 or 4 months. Sri Lanka is now, again, run by the Sri Lankan government. Sri Lankan cricket is run by the Sri Lankan government once again. So that just shows how seriously the Wolf Report was taken.
Yes, that's certainly the thing. The thing is, yes, there needs to be a distinction between government interference and government assistance. And government assistance is certainly needed for the sport in all countries, but particularly in these developing global nations, these associate affiliate members. But it's government interference that the Wolf Report sought to stamp out, and unfortunately, in that regard, it won't be succeeding. As we can see, Shanath Jayasuriya just appointed as the Sri Lankan chairman of selectors, while also being a member of parliament of the ruling party. So, unfortunately, don't see these sorts of things, particularly in the subcontinent, halting any time soon.
Javi, I had one other question about the teams. There were a couple of teams that were in the second tier tournament that weren't there. Korea was one. Korea is particularly interesting because, in theory, they should play the Asian Games next year because they're hosting it. Do you know whether why they didn't come, or was it just a cost thing?
Yeah, I'm not totally aware why the Koreans were not able to make it. I do know that the Philippines have had some administrative issues, and the ICC was not keen for them to participate. But yes, certainly the cost issue is a massive factor for these countries.
Let's move on to the PNG. After the tournament, played two one-day matches against the second 11s of Northern Districts and Auckland, the local first-class side. They lost both matches fairly easily. In the first, Auckland made 256 for 8, Although at one stage it looked like they were actually on track for probably about 200 to 220 maybe, and then really kicked on. But PNG only replied with 110 all out. And the second Northern Districts made 343 for 9, and PNG were only made 221 for 5. Were the losses as big as the scorecard suggests?
I don't believe they were. I was present at the Auckland A Papua New Guinea game, which was the first of those warm-up games, and Papua Guinea had a nervous start with the ball. They gave away about 36 runs or so in the first five overs, but they dominated the next 35 overs with the ball. They had Auckland A 159 for 7 in about the 40th over, and then this was probably where the game awareness took over, and they didn't bring back their best bowlers to target the tail and try and finish the innings off. And they let Auckland A escape 256, and that was realistically probably 20, 30 runs too many for PNG to chase. And Auckland A had two first-class bowlers, Lockie Ferguson and Matt Quinn, opening up for them. And the difference in pace was very noticeable. They really struggled to lay bat on ball against Ferguson particularly. And then the lower order just seemed to basically give up and just have a heave, and the game finished quickly. But I would, yes, say that the margin of 146 runs definitely flattered Auckland A, who didn't play particularly well. And in the next game, I was not present, but I did hear that the bowling struggled, just too short, too wide. But the positive was in the batting. They did bat 50 overs. They did only lose 5 wickets, and Lega Siaka made 100. So that's a good sign that they are, again, capable of competing for periods of games, and the challenge is to make that competing for the whole game.
And largely that's just a depth thing, isn't it? Because if Asad Vala got going, they could probably chase any total almost. But if he's only going to make 15 or 20, and they're really depending on players that maybe aren't quite at that standard, is that the...
Yes, that's right. So a side like PNG has considerable depth when it comes to the regional tournaments, but when they make the step up to play better teams, the same issues that plague the other regional teams also come back to hit PNG in terms of, yes, the depth is not there. They have 3-4 key players that are relied on, and then again, if they don't perform, it's a struggle to beat any team that's got more experience than them, like these Auckland A and Northern Districts A sides.
In terms of pure talent, would PNG be able to fit in with some of those players? And I guess, are there possibly some New Zealand sides that might be looking at some of these players, not just in PNG, but in some of the Pacific Islands, to play for them?
Yes, it's an interesting idea, because in the Samoan team there were quite a few premier club cricketers in Auckland who were in the Samoan side. Don't think they would be near Auckland A selection at the moment, but certainly the potential option is there, and certainly a few of those PNG players would not be out of place. They didn't look out of place playing these A sides, and with the right assistance again, playing club cricket and scoring lots of runs or taking lots of wickets in, say, New Zealand, and some New Zealand club somewhere would certainly be a realistic option, and then hopefully playing in some regional representative capacity. But again, it does come down to assistance. I know that a few of the Papua New Guinea players have been playing on the Gold Coast club cricket in recent seasons there, which has been good for their development, but there is the sense that they need to take a further step, that now they've probably reached the limit of what they can learn from playing on the Gold Coast, and they need to go and experience new conditions and experience a different standard and level of cricket. So certainly I would think New Zealand would be a very good option, considering the relative lack of player depth in New Zealand cricket as a whole generally.
This also is probably a question for New Zealand, in the sense that Murphy Sua, who I think played for Samoa, a former New Zealand international.
Yes, he played and coached for them.
Was he saying that a lot of Polynesian kids in New Zealand don't actually take up cricket? Obviously, rugby's very much the thing there, but partly because they don't realise that they might have the option to not only play for New Zealand or the first-class sides, but the Philippines Polynesian sides, because they qualify for them. So New Zealand cricket, should New Zealand cricket be taking a much stronger role within these regional areas to try and not just for those, their benefit, but also for New Zealand's benefit, potentially, if they can?
Yes, certainly they should be, but they're not. And this is, this reflects the population spread in Auckland cricket generally, and in cricket in New Zealand generally. It is still overwhelmingly white males who play the game. And as an example, actually, at Auckland Cricket's last annual general meeting, there were 45 or so people in attendance, and only two of those faces were not white, and those two faces were myself and Murphy Sewer. And that, to me, showed exactly where New Zealand cricket and all the major associations have failed to encourage people from other communities to play cricket. There has not been good encouragement in school levels. School programs are usually targeted at the more middle-class areas. And also, just generally, there's no effort to compete with the other sports that are on offer. Obviously, rugby union and rugby league are big factors that Polynesian kids like to play, but New Zealand cricket, have they tried enough? I would say no. And that probably goes for other communities as well. Like, the Indian community has certainly got plenty of people playing cricket, naturally, but not enough of those have been coming through at the higher levels, and that is because there's a certain insular mentality and a perception that they're not going to get a fair go in the mainstream community. So they just prefer to play amongst themselves, and that's an attitude that New Zealand cricket needs to be doing more to try and change. But unfortunately, New Zealand cricket would struggle to run a sausage sizzle fundraiser at the moment, so expecting them to do too much would be out of the question.
It's actually similar to the situation that English cricket found itself with the Asian community in England up until probably the late 1980s, early 1990s, where the Asian community tended to play in their own clubs and amongst themselves, and it's actually taken quite a long time to sort of integrate them into the mainstream cricket community.
Yes, well, I noticed that recently on ESPN Cricket Info there was a feature series on Asian communities in English cricket. Yes. And it seems as though, yes, there's been progress made, but there's still a lot of progress to be made. And that exactly shows why New Zealand cricket needs to start now, because this process isn't just going to happen in 5 years. You're not going to just get the number of Polynesian cricketers skyrocket. It's a gradual process. It's going to take 10 years to fully get people into the game, and that's because once you get people involved, it becomes a legacy thing. Polynesian people who've played the game will then hopefully pass it down to their children and their relatives and so forth and so forth. So that is why it is extremely important that New Zealand cricket do make a push soon, because there's a lot of talent out there and there are career options, but the game needs to be made more accessible to these communities, and it's not doing that at the moment.
A final question, Ali, on the tournament, which is media coverage. There probably wasn't almost any media coverage of the tournament, despite the fact that it's an international tournament and there are English journalists who, in theory, could have attended one of the days and talked about it. So how does a tournament like this expand itself in the range of people who actually talk about it and get some recognition in the wider cricket community?
Yes, media coverage was probably not as high as it could have been. Yes, there was a member of the BBC who came and viewed one of the days. There was an article in the New Zealand Herald. There was also a feature with Ross Taylor, who came on behalf of Sky Television New Zealand's cricket show, which screens weekly in New Zealand. But yes, the issue I would have thought with this tournament was a lack of engagement with the ethnic elements in Auckland. So we have about three or four Indian ethnic radio stations here, and they were not aware that the tournament was happening until I actually contacted them after the opening day. And unfortunately, they did not seem to be able to make much progress in terms of coming to the grounds and viewing games, but they were able to announce scores on their on the air as it happened. But it is a challenge, and again, it comes back to engagement of communities. Particularly the Fijian Indian community is quite strong in New Zealand, and the fact that they were not aware of the tournament again shows how much work needs to be done to make these communities feel like it is one cricket family, not several separate, distinct segments. But it can be done. There was interest from local papers, and once the tournament started progressing, we got phone calls from Fiji News, TV in Fiji, and from other outlets from a few of the other countries. So it's not impossible. Certainly this region will always struggle to get significant exposure because of where it is and having not had any teams progress to the highest level, which is why it is very important for the region that Papua New Guinea do make it to the World 2020 as one of these six qualifiers. When that happens, then all of a sudden there will be world attention, there will be world exposure. Journalists from all over the world will be attending, and there will be a chance for them to tell their story and get their name out there. And it is difficult. A lot of these teams are quite shy as well, and they're not really aware that self-promotion is what's needed to get more exposure and more funds coming in. But it's a process. It's not all doom and gloom, but it certainly, again, needs a lot of work.
It's, yeah, and Fiji, too, they're one of the great success stories of the last probably 5 years in terms of both their improvement and their development. They have listed something like 100,000 cricketers on their statistics, whether that's accurate or not, I'm not sure, but that makes up something like an eighth of the cricketers in the world, in the associate world, that are actually doing these school programs. So they're doing something really good there, and hopefully they can take that out and share their experience as well with the rest of the
Yes, that's right, and it shows what's possible, because a country like PNG, which is relatively underdeveloped in comparison to some of the other associate countries, they have made massive strides. And then you look at America, where cricket has just completely stagnated and, in fact, probably regressed, despite the massive population base over there, despite the natural abundance of funds and resources, despite the potential for so much to be done there. They've done nothing in America. But to see that in PNG, with limited resources, with limited funds, in fact, even with limited people, things can be done. And it's hopefully a message that's being sent to other associate nations that it's not impossible. And hopefully this is where the ICC regional areas try to reward teams that have been making clear progress and not continuing to engage with associations that seem to have abdicated their responsibility to the game, such as USACA.
Yeah, I think there's a move within the ICC development program to not just give the same amount of funding to every associate and affiliate member, but to have a base amount of funding and then base the rest of the funding on certain criteria, the number of players, number of grounds, and within that, the number of players, the number of, you know, homegrown players that are being produced rather than relying on expatriate communities, as a few of the US obviously do, and within the grounds, producing grounds with turf wickets as well. I think the number of grounds with turf wickets is a criteria in this scorecard system, I think they call it. And I think Papua New Guinea now have a turf wicket facility in Port Moresby, Amini Park. And so they are, you know, they're punching above their weight. They do, as you say, they're doing a lot with limited resources. And it's a shame that they get less attention almost than the US. I'd much rather be seeing Cricket New Zealand partnering with Cricket Papua New Guinea than with USACA. I think they'd probably get less financially out of it, but certainly more cricket-wise out of a partnership like that.
Yes, well, I'd argue at the moment New Zealand cricket isn't getting anything financially out of the American deal either, but I guess that's another story. But yes, that is one thing that the expatriates, that seemed to be a common notion as well among people who didn't know anything about these teams or about this tournament, that these teams are just mostly full of expatriates playing. And there were a few, but certainly an overwhelming majority of the players were native-born players who played their cricket in that country and learnt their cricket in that country and had coaching and everything there. So that was really good to see. So this is developing a homegrown base. Again, it goes back to the legacy point. That's how you get cricket developed in the country as a whole. Whereas if you have expatriates coming or expatriates dominating your cricket, that's why you can see in America cricket has not taken hold in most of the minds of the American-born populace, because the legacies are not being passed down, because the communities that play cricket in America have been relatively insulated from the mainstream population.
On that note, Aria, I know you have to go, so I might let you do so. Thank you for joining, and hopefully we'll hear from you again if there's more regional tournaments that you get to.
Certainly, it was my pleasure to be on, and it was a fantastic week of cricket and a great tournament. So well done at least to the ICC East Asia Pacific Region and to Auckland Cricket, who did a fantastic job.
Cool, thank you.
Thanks.
Andrew, the Americas tournament, we should wrap that up. Neither of us saw any of this. I read a couple of articles from the Bahamas local newspaper, and that's pretty much the information I have. They were the clear winner, 4 wins. They weren't absolutely dominant, but they came through in every game. There's no final, which, again, we talked last week about consistency. Every tournament is slightly different. They'll progress to America's Division 1. But the other four teams are really closely matched. Panama snuck in the second, Turks and Caicos were relegated, but it was a tight tournament overall, from what we can tell.
Yeah, and I think the main story of coming out of the tournament is, once again, the constant decline of Argentina. It's not as if they're not producing new players. They are producing new players. They just don't seem to be as good as the ones who are leaving. Had results gone differently on the final day, they could have found themselves relegated to Division 3 and the potentially awkward chance of having to come up against the Falkland Islands, which I think would want to be avoided by all concerned. I doubt Argentina would actually play the Falkland Islands. I know they abstained against the Falkland Islands becoming an ICC member. They didn't actually vote against it, but from what I've heard, they probably wouldn't play them. And I assume that would have then counted as a forfeit to the Falkland Islands. But fortunately, that was prevented. It was like I was at ICC Europe Division 2 in 2010, where the best team out of France, Germany, and Israel was going to go to World League Division 8 in Kuwait, and they were sort of hoping that Israel wouldn't be that team because Israeli citizens aren't allowed into Kuwait. So there are these diplomatic incidents that are fortunately avoided, and it was in this case. So we don't have to cross that bridge yet, but if Argentina do continue this decline, they could find themselves in Division 3 in the Americas, which is actually quite surprising, given, I think, 10 years ago, I think they came third in Division 1, and now they come in, next to last in Division 2. It's quite a drastic drop in quality in Argentinian cricket.
Yeah, and they have such a long history of cricket as well, and they're such a big country. I mean, some of these countries they're playing against have a couple of million people. They have, I think, 40 million, 60 million maybe in Argentina, so it's... They're the sort of country, I'm a bit strange perhaps, but I like to see big countries do well at ICC Associate Events.
Yeah.
That means that they're big countries are going to grow the game in the long term. With no disrespect at all to Jersey and Guernsey, they're probably at the limit of their ability at the moment.
Yeah. And it's the it's the potential gateway to South America. Obviously, Guyana play within the West Indies, but Argentina, the gateway to the Spanish-speaking South America, and to a lesser extent, the obviously Brazil are a Portuguese-speaking country, that they're sort of quite closely linked with Argentina. But Suriname seems to have sort of gone ahead of them within the South American region now. And it's a shame because I think Argentina could help, you know, promote the game in places like Chile and Peru to some extent. So it's a shame to see them dropping down the rankings like this.
But on the plus side, they did win, and they didn't get relegated. I think it was 21 consecutive games they lost to IFS 11, when I looked it up. I might have missed a win, but maybe it wasn't quite that bad, but something like 4 years without a win is horrendous for anything.
Yeah.
And well done to the Bahamas, who go on. I think that tournament is in March, early March.
It's in March, and then some of the teams, the USA, Bermuda, and the Cayman Islands stay to play some 50-over games to prepare for World League Division 3 in Bermuda in April, is it? I think April? Yeah.
So, lots of cricket that we're putting. In fact, the next month of cricket, I put a calendar on my site. It shows the cricket. There's an awful lot of cricket coming up for Associate Little, so there's a lot for us to talk about.
Yes, absolutely.
One thing we wanted to talk about today was that Associate players are not only popping up in tournaments, they're popping up all over the world. The Bangladesh Premier League we've seen some really good performances by a whole bunch of Associate players.
I think most of them were actually in the tournament originally. After the withdrawal of the Pakistani players, the associate players were called on. There quite a few players from Afghanistan, Sami Ulda, Shenwari, Mohamed Nabi, Shapur Zadran, and the sort of welcome return after a year out with injury of Hamid Azam. Ireland had Paul Sterling and the two O'Briens, Kevin and Niall. I think there was a couple of other associate players in squads but didn't get a game. I think Rizwan Chima of Canada was in a squad but didn't play, and indeed ended up back playing for Canada on their tour of Trinidad. But all have done quite well. Ryan Sendurskaya was there as well, if we still count him as an associate player after 2 years out of international cricket. I think Ryan Sendurskaya and Paul Sterling finished in the top 10 run scorers. And I think Kevin O'Brien and Mohamed Nabi are in the top 10 wicket takers in the tournament. They show that they can play at this level. Mohamed Nabi in the preliminary final the other day, when Chris Gayle scored that century, was it 114, I think, off 51 balls, bowled better than anybody else in his team. He took two wickets for just 17 runs off four overs, which in a total of 197, I think it was, is a spectacular performance. I mean, any time you go for less than a run a ball in 2020 is spectacular, but when you've got Chris Gayle smashing it to all parts, to only go for 17 runs or four overs is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I noticed actually Hamid Hassan, whose return is definitely welcome. I think he's everywhere except Scotland, who have to play him in a match.
Oh, yes.
he's gone for, he's averaging 13 and going for less than a run a ball. So it's not just a return, it's a return to form, I hope. Spectacular.
It's welcome for Afghanistan. You know, they've lacked. Shapur Zadran also bowls at express pace, but doesn't have the accuracy of Hamid Hassan. Hamid Hassan is that he bowls it fast and straight, and he can cause problems for the best batsman within associate cricket. And I think had they had him at the World 2020 last year, they could have well caused some more problems for India and England than they otherwise would have done. Otherwise, did.
Let's talk about associate players in these tournaments, because one of the things I certainly think is that what we'll see in the future is that this is where we want associate players to be It's extremely unlikely that the Associated Nations, at their current size and even in their future size, are going to be able to pay the wages of their best players at the level that's allowing them to be professional. But if they're able to make a professional career in one or two 2020 leagues and maybe some first-class leagues, then that's going to raise their level of game. They're going to have that opportunity to train with players that are of a high standard, so they, which is obviously a lot better than playing and training with the local squads and certainly local club cricket.
Yeah, and I think it has the potential of giving them another avenue of income to keep them actually playing internationally for the associate side. I'm always very cynical about this, claiming that Owen Morgan wanted to play at a higher level. I think there is a financial element to this as well. You see it in rugby league, where Ireland and Scotland now have the same status within rugby league as England do, and yet in the last couple of years, I think about four players have switched from Ireland and Scotland to playing for England, because England are the higher profile side, they play against the better teams, and therefore can pay more money. And I think there is a financial element to these decisions to switch for England as well, for Owen Morgan, for Ed Joyce in the past, and now Boyd Rankin giving up playing for Ireland. I don't think he's anywhere near the England side, unfortunately for him. So if they can earn money from these 2020 leagues, it gives them a chance to carry on playing for their home country. You know, I'm sure in his heart of hearts, Owen Morgan would rather be playing international cricket for Ireland than for England. But England can give him that financial security he needs as a professional cricketer, which Ireland cannot. But Ireland, in conjunction with a Bangladeshi Premier League contract or even an Indian Premier League contract, maybe they can.
Yeah, well, we see this, but Ireland released their contract list this week, and they have, I think, five players on full contracts who aren't playing county cricket or equivalent, maybe eight players who are playing county cricket who get the lower level contract because they're financially secure at the level that they're playing, and Ireland is just topping them up to play thing. And it's also something obviously we see in those other sports. Football is a classic example. I don't think an Irish footballer has played in Ireland except maybe as a junior in maybe 20 years.
Yeah, certainly. Because there's maybe the odd one. It used to be the English player discovers he's got an Irish granny and can therefore play for Ireland. It's less of that now. There are players who played as juniors in Ireland and have since moved to play in the Premier League. It's not quite as bad as it was in when Jack Charlton was the Ireland manager. The joke was, if you've ever had a pint of Guinness, you could play football for Ireland. It's not quite that like that these days. But
you can go back, probably 50 years, and they've always plied their trade in those leagues. And the Scottish players as well, I guess, maybe to a lesser extent, the Scottish leagues will put more points.
Yeah, so Scotland obviously have Rangers and Celtic at quite a high level. Well, Celtic now, Rangers have been relegated down the thing due to going into administration. But yes, some of the Scotland players do stay in Scotland, but certainly within the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, obviously they play separately in soccer. Their top players all play their trade in England and always have done. There is always the worry of players not being released. The ICC do have these mandatory release matches, but I think those rules aren't really worth the paper they're written on. Ryan Tenderscarter obviously hasn't played in any of the mandatory release matches for the Netherlands in the last 2 years. I think the Ireland players in county cricket now actually have it written into their contracts that they will be released for mandatory release matches. I think the hope is that they'll play in other matches as well. The squad that's been named for the tour of the UAE obviously includes all the county players in the Intercontinental Cup side. But the Intercontinental Cup matches that are played during the English season, those players are unlikely to be available. So the William Porterfield doesn't play the Intercontinental Cup matches that take place during the England season, for example. So there is a worry that players although they will continue to play for their associate side, won't always be available due to county cricket commitments or commitments elsewhere as well.
Which fundamentally, I mean, people talk about a windows for 2020 cricket and the problems that that will cause the Test Nations, but from an associate point of view, a window would be absolutely awesome because can play and
pictures can be planned around the window. And it's a lot easier to do that with associate cricket with, you know, the infrequent matches, you know, rather than be playing, you know, 15, you know, was it? I think England and Australia are going to be playing about 24 matches within about 6 months against each other. Shortly, you're only playing, maybe 15 matches a year, and it's easier to fit a window into the schedule of an associate nation than it is into a full member nation.
Well, we should wrap this up, and next week we will see the Africa's Division One tournament. There are 5 teams in that whose names I didn't write down, but it will be Uganda, Kenya, Nigeria, Tanzania and Botswana, I think. Last time in this tournament, Kenya played an under-19 squad, I think.
They're also about to get to the next stage, so...
Presumably their full squad will come this time. Yeah, do you see any chance of an upset, or is this Uganda's and Kenya's going to kind of roll through this?
You'd think that there wouldn't be an upset. Tanzania probably aren't as good as they were a few years ago. I think it's quite similar to, you know, the East Asia Pacific, where Papua New Guinea are quite a long way ahead of the rest. Uganda and Kenya are quite a long way ahead of the rest in Africa. So it's hard to see another team, you know, qualifying ahead of Uganda and Kenya. I think it'll be interesting who actually wins a tournament between Uganda and Kenya. Kenya are certainly on the slide, you know, so they didn't do well in the global qualifier last year. I think Uganda could well win the tournament overall. As to whether, if any of the other teams are going to come through, it will be Tanzania. I think Nigeria and Botswana are quite a way off. Tanzania, it'd be nice to see if they could to do it, but I don't think they will.
And on that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks again, Andrew.
Yep, no problem.
Thanks, everyone.